Okay, well, let's do that. I did assign you 50A, didn't I? Formally. Okay, so I'll go through that real quick. And don't forget, Thursday, day after tomorrow, we'll have a quiz on the imperative and subjunctive of LUO. So this will be a test where you have to kind of go both ways. In other words, I'll give you the Greek and ask you to parse it, you know, or either parse it or give the English equivalent. Probably parsing would be the safest, because then you avoid a lot of the nuances of translation between aorist and imperfect and stuff like that. So what I'll do is, give you, in some cases I'll give you the Greek form and then have you give me the English parsing. Tell me if it's, aorist if it's imperative or subjunctive. It's going to be between imperatives and subjunctives, but then the person and the number, so forth, in the tense. And then I'll go the other direction, too. I'll give you the information, and then you give me the form. That's always the harder way to go. But there'll be some of both. And then we'll have another quiz coming up probably next week or the week after. We'll see how things go. That will spotlight a few. I'll tell you specifically what's in these last few chapters you'll be responsible for. Perfect and pluperfect for one. And yes?
Will we have anything on accent, second aorist, translation, or the meaning of?
On this first quiz coming up, no, the accents that are necessary to distinguish forms, I think, just for the verb luo, I think I will, just because of some of the subjunctives especially. Don't worry about it so much for imperatives, but for the subjunctives, pay attention to the accents, just because in some instances they make all the difference between the forms. So watch your accents and your subjunctives on luo only. But don't worry about second aorist and so forth, because luo's first aorist, and that's the only one we're going to worry about here. I just want to basically get, have a quiz to really try to drill in at least luo for recognition purposes. And then I think you'll be able to pretty much get by recognizing the other forms. Okay, so that'll be for this Thursday, day after tomorrow. Imperative and subjunctive. And you may have to write up your own paradigm for the imperative, like I said, because the textbook, I think you can get it from your workbook if you did the workbook right. But make sure when you write up your paradigm, you got it right, so that you don't study the wrong forms and then get them wrong on the test because of that. If you want to double check, you might check another grammar, Grit Machen or one of the others that may have a whole paradigm written out someplace. I'm not positive if he does or not, but I think he probably does. Huh? Analytical has it too. That's good. You can just check the analytical and have your paradigm. Do they do it with LUO too, so you have it? Okay, good. And there's, I don't know if that chart's still on the wall in the Greek in the classroom here. That color-coded chart, you can probably use that. Find something so you've got a good, accurate paradigm. Okay, 50A then. We'll just run through this. I'll just go through this fairly quickly here, and then we'll do some translating today. Number one, what you're supposed to do, they give you the indicative, then you give the subjunctive, imperative, and optative form. Just a matter of comparing these forms. It's kind of good to have this exercise and then to have this down here so you can come back from time to time and look at it and just scan and see the basic differences between the forms. Okay, number one, graphes. The subjunctive would be graphes, but it's spelt with phi. Well, gamma, rho, alpha, phi, eta with the order subscript, sigma. And imperative, graphe, with an epsilon. The optative, graphois, with omicron, iota, sigma. So we've got subjunctive, graphes, graphe, and graphois, in order. The second one, estin, the subjunctive would be a, with just an eta with the order subscript, with your circumflex and smooth breathing. You got just about every kind of mark you can get on one eta there. Then the imperative would be esto or eto. Two options on that one. Esto and or eto. The third person you get. Now the eto would be eta tau omega, and the esto would be epsilon sigma tau omega. Okay. Optative aa. Epsilon iota eta. Epsilon iota eta. Smooth breathing on the epsilon iota. And then thirdly, labeta. Subjunctive would be labeta, no augment, and an eta instead of the epsilon there in the ending. So So lambda, alpha, beta, eta, tau, epsilon. Imperative, labeta, again, no augment, and epsilon, tau, epsilon ending. Optative, laboite. Lambda, alpha, beta, omicron, iota, tau, epsilon. Number four, genoskase. Subjunctive form would be sound pretty much the same, genoskase, with an eta, with the iota subscript sigma ending instead of the epsilon iota. Imperative, genoske, that would be gamma iota nu omicron sigma kappa epsilon. Optative, genoskois, gamma iota nu omega sigma kappa omicron iota sigma. Always get that omicron iota there as a typical optative ending. Then fifthly, erketai, subjunctive, erketai, just an eta there instead of an epsilon, erketai. Imperative, erkesto, epsilon rho, chi, epsilon sigma theta omega, erkesto. And optative, erkoito, epsilon rho, chi, omicron iota tau, omicron. Number six, ALFS. Question? Okay. The very last form I gave you was erkoito. Epsilon rho chi omicron iota tau omicron. Okay. Omicron iota tau omicron. Number six, ALFS. Subjunctive ALFACE with eta with the iota subscript sigma ending. Question?
Shouldn't you take the augment off that when you return to ALFACE?
Yes, it should be L-face, yeah. Did I say L-face? I'm sorry. Yeah, I mispronounced it. It's epsilon. Yeah, epsilon, lambda, theta, eta, eta with the iota subscript sigma.
I wasn't
Thank
sure
you.
Whether to do it that way or not, because in one sense, being an irregular form...
Yeah, you don't always know. No, you don't always know for sure. These are among the trickiest ones there are. So you have to basically know what the base was without the augment. I think one of the chapters back there gave you... I think this is one of the verbs they gave you in that old section, letting you know what the roots were without the augment, because it is tricky. When a verb begins with an epsilon or an alpha or something like that, then, of course, both the epsilons and the alphas get eta when they become augmented. And if you see only the augmented form, then it's hard to go back the other way. You've got several options as to what it might be. Mm-hmm. Or it may not even be changed at all. Yeah.
That wasn't necessarily a question. The form originally had an epsilon.
Mm-hmm.
But it's irregular.
Oh, yeah.
The other form,
yeah.
So you can't, even then,
right.
You can't necessarily say that it's an augment.
Yeah, that's another one of the problems, is when it goes irregular, you don't really know what that thing came from or how to connect it back. That's a good point. And that's really the case in this one. It's not a matter of just having this is from air from mine. You get so much depletion, you don't really know what's going on. And because you've got a whole class of those, plus... See, the problem is you get those confused with these other types where it was augmented, and you don't know what you started with. So that's what they had to give you that chart. And that's really why the quickest way to find those things out for common verbs is using this chart in the back of Getches, finding your principal parts. And then you can find the form there in the list of the principal parts and then look backwards and so forth, at least if you know what the verb basically is. That's probably the quickest way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it is L-face. Mispronounce that. It's L-face. Then the imperative, Elta, again, epsilon, lambda, theta, epsilon. Optative, Elthois, epsilon, lambda, theta, omicron, iota, sigma. So you've got that L, that base coming through there, but then the ending's different. Number seven, epleroson. The subjunctive would be pleirososin or pleirososi, and again no augment, but it's P, lambda, eta, rho, omega, sigma, iota, optional nu. Imperative, pleirosatosan, P, lambda, eta, rho, omega, sigma, alpha, tau, omega, sigma, alpha, nu. Big mouthful there. Optative, pleirosain. Pleirosian should be pronounced. P, lambda, eta, rho, omega, sigma, alpha, iota, epsilon, nu. Alpha, iota, epsilon, nu. It's an unusual combination. You seldom see the vowels. Number eight, Yeah, baptistes should be baptistes, and it's pronounced pretty much the same except no augment, and then there's a subscript on the eta at the ending. Question? I didn't put my accents down on this one, but over the eta?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably correct. Yeah, if you checked it there. Mm-hmm. That's right, the aorist passes are going to get that circumflex. Yeah, better toss that in here. Okay, then your imperative, baptistheti, eta, I'll spell the whole thing. Beta, alpha, p, tau, iota, sigma, theta, eta, tau, iota. Baptistheti. And optative, baptistheis. Again, the beta, alpha, p, tau, iota, sigma, theta, epsilon, iota, eta, sigma. Epsilon, iota, eta, sigma. Number 9, edioxas, just a second person singular aorist active form. For the subjunctive, we want delta, iota, omega, xi, eta, sigma, deoxase, eta with the iota subscript, sigma, I should say. So delta, iota, omega, sigma, delta, iota, omega, xi, eta with the iota subscript, and sigma. Imperative, deoxone, delta, iota, omega, sigma, delta, iota, omega, xi, again, omicron, nu. And optative, delta, iota, omega, xi, alpha, iota, sigma, deoxase. Alpha, iota, sigma. Okay, Zaris one's getting thematic alphas there. And number 10, ethaazo from theaomai. That's a good one. The subjunctive, theaase, theta, epsilon, alpha, sigma, eta with the iota subscript. Imperative, theaasai, theta, epsilon, alpha, sigma, alpha, iota. And optative, theasio, just putting an omicron on the end of the previous form, theta, epsilon, alpha, sigma, alpha, iota, omicron. Okay, questions, Mark?
Could you repeat the optative form for number 8?
Number 8 optative form, baptistheis, beta, alpha, p, tau, iota, sigma, theta, epsilon, iota, eta, sigma. Epsilon, iota, eta, sigma.
Do number 10 in the imperative
and
the optative again?
10 in the number 10 in the imperative would be theta epsilon alpha sigma alpha iota. Alpha iota ending. And then the optative form, just add an omicron to that.
I'm
not understanding
why you got the
optative. Okay.
Imperative.
Okay. Just what did you have there? What was it?
Well, I've been.
Second person singular. Let's see, we'll have to. So you've got a deponent verb there. So it's using middle forms. Did you find, as long as you see it, otherwise we can go back and try to track it down for you.
Okay.
And then the optative, that would be theta psi o, theta epsilon alpha sigma alpha iota omicron. Okay. All right. Now, I guess there's nothing much to cover as far as review for this quiz coming up, just imperative and subjunctive forms, it's just memorization, I guess. It's just forms. But it'll go both ways. In other words, sometimes I'll give you the Greek and have you give me the parsing for it. Other times I'll just say, since they're all from the verb blue, I'll just say, imperative, second person plural, aorist or something like that. So I'll just give you the information and you give me the form.
I'm not understanding what the outside.
Okay. Well, let's see.
I don't see it all.
Yeah. If you take a look at page 310, And page 310 in your paradigm for the optative mood, if you look at number four there, the paradigms, first aorist middle.
I know it's wrong. Never mind.
Did
you, I was looking at the subjunctive endings here.
Oh, yeah, no wonder that wouldn't work. Okay.
Wrong thing.
I do it every time. Okay. Well, if you will, take out your UBS text. You've got one with you. If you don't, I think there's some on the back. Are there? No, maybe they're not. Yeah, we need to run over to the library. Or if you can just scoot next to somebody who's got one, we can both share one. And open to John 1.
We'll be doing some kind of exercises in Dan and Nancy.
Probably not formal exercise like we've had here, because he doesn't, you know, set his book up quite the same way. But what we will do some things analogous. We'll be probably doing a lot of some blackboard work, and the kinds of things we're going to be looking at in Dana and Matthew are not, don't lend themselves so much to exercise. We've already kind of gone through the forms. Now we're going to go look at the more subtle details in terms of semantics and meaning and that type of thing. When we get to diagramming, we'll be doing some exercises.
You know, I'll get signing us to.
That'll mainly be in the test. I think most of it, our class time is kind of our exercise time. In other words, you can kind of prepare. You'll know basically where we are. It'd be a good idea to look ahead to see, get a familiarity with the text and so forth. So what we're doing it in class, you'll be able to do it quicker. So that's mainly our exercise there. And then there'll be translation tests like we have in Hebrew, where I'll just tell you, be responsible for John chapter, the Gospel of John chapters 2, 3, and 4, and you'll get a section within, you don't know which one it'll be, and then you'll have to translate, that type of thing. I'll try to pick things that you don't know so well in the scriptures, sometimes you can do it without even looking at the Greek. Yeah, right. And I'll check and I'll make sure that there's not too many King James-isms in it, you just memorize the King James. Yeah, you do it from the Septuagint or something, that would really be... No, I do want to do it from something you are basically familiar with, but... Yeah, the Apocrypha, right, that would do it. Or get some classical Greek or something. All right. Verse 1 then, I think we'll start over here with John. You can do verse 1 and give a translation. Just read, we'll go verse by verse, read the Greek, and then give a translation for it the best you can. If there are vocab words and so forth that you're not familiar with, just ask. And then if there's any unusual grammatical features, I'll point those out and so forth, and we'll maybe have a little discussion as we go.
I wondered why for the past year and a half I've said
in
first
speech. Uh-huh. You've been waiting for John 1:1. Okay. Okay. But it's going to get harder from here on out.
Erake en hologos kai hologos en proston theon kai theos en hologos.
Okay.
This is one thing I've always wondered, why they put a B in there. In beginning.
Yeah, that's really what it is.
Mm-hmm. The logos was the logos. Or the logos was is what it
is. Yeah, that'd probably even be better, actually. In the beginning, the logos was.
In beginning, the logos was. And the logos was toward the God.
Mm-hmm.
God, and the logos was God.
Right, good. And why did you select the logos as the subject of that predicate construction?
It's more
definite of the two, yeah. With the article, so forth, it is. Yeah. Okay, good. Anybody with any... And also, I want to open it up for anybody that has a question about a grammatical feature or something that you want to point out. Yes, Mark?
as far as translating in the beginning or in the beginning, took a few notes on first chapter of John, and something I found in ATR said, Arche is definite, though anastras like are at home, in town, and similar, and the similar leadership and
Bittersheath in the Hebrew. Yeah.
So,
Same kind of thing in Genesis 1. Bereshith doesn't have the article either. And I think what he's getting at is semantically, there's only one beginning to something. And because of its meaning, it gains that sense. And so in English, even you could tell, it's awkward to say in English, in beginning, just because there's only one beginning to something. And I think that's the sense, you know, and he's brought that out, that it doesn't have the article, but it's definite because of its semantic meaning and the way it's used.
Actually, in one sense, in the way we relate to things, there is only one beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in God's view, mm-hmm. there isn't necessarily one.
Well, yeah, it's key to our environment.
Right.
I think there's something else, too, here. Where I wouldn't advocate a translation of ignoring the article necessarily, yet there's a certain kind of feeling you get. This is one of the things we're going to explore this year in Dane and Manti, coming up here soon, is article versus no article. You know, there's a lot of, you know, we've got a kind of a basic rule of thumb that if you see the article translated with a D in English and so forth. But the real distinction is sometimes more subtle than that as far as trying to translate it in English. And I think that even without the article here, we may want to go ahead and translate in the beginning just because that's common to our mode. Yet, there's a kind of a quality or characteristic idea that's being seen here. Rather than trying to point out just specifically a point in time without any other consideration, it seems to be setting the character and the flavor of the whole thing in beginning, in the beginning kind of time, as it were, this is going on. It's really, maybe I didn't, no need to elaborate on that, but there's a subtle feeling there that's real hard to put in specific translation.
Maybe another consideration that since God has always been creating,
mm-hmm.
that's a
reasonable supposition. Yeah.
We conjecture would intend to be a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
from his perspective, yeah, it would be. And from our perspective, it's the beginning, the only one we know about.
So
yeah.
maybe the wisest thing would be to put the in brackets or just mm-hmm. Make a footnote.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you were doing an exegesis on this passage and you wanted to elaborate on this point, that might be the way to do it. Either put that in parentheses, put a footnote down there, and maybe make some of the comments that on the notes that you looked up. That's always good information to bring in. And if it's different, if you're translating it different than the literal rendering would be, give an indication as to why and what other things in the context are giving you that information. Okay, and remember these languages aren't one-to-one correspondence. There's especially in this use of the article, sometimes you'll see no article when you think there ought to be one. Sometimes you'll see one where you can't figure out why there is one. And generally, the rule of thumb is, follows pretty well, but there are going to be areas where it may not seem normal to you. And that's only because English is a different language than Greek, and they're not meanings and the ideas are not easily transferable. Okay, verse 2. Jim. Okay.
This was in the beginning, of course.
Yes. Yeah, this was. Now, hutos, of course, is being used as a substantive here, so you might say this one was in the beginning toward God. Okay. Verse 3. Dan.
Onto the onto aginito tied to the wrist. Onto aginito uda skin.
Okay.
Oh, hold the aginito.
Oh, yeah, this is kind of... what's happened here is that the numbering of the verses is different in some of the texts and so forth. So, oftentimes... once you leave it, the way they put it in the UBS, why don't you leave it for the next person there? And you can stop with him there.
Okay.
But there'll be, King James puts it at the end of verse 3, and the other translations and the other texts put it, let's see, the King James puts the whole gag on in, yes, at the end of verse 3, and the others are, in effect, putting it at the beginning of verse 4, so dividing your sentence there. So why don't you stop with a period there, and then we'll let the other person start with whole gag on in.
Okay. Would it be all...
Mm-hmm.
Through him became.
Yeah, became or came to be, something like that. Yeah, from Ginomai.
And
This is interesting. Actually, this, the form out two is masculine genitive, could be neuter genitive too, but the antecedent noun is logos.
Okay.
And so it's got to be masculine to agree with logos. So this is kind of a debatable point. If you know that the logos is a person, then you can translate it him. That's what Trinitarians think they know. So they translated him. I would prefer just translating it, although, you know, that sounds anathema to a Trinitarian. I mean, how can you call the logos an it? But it hasn't been personalized yet. During the course of this, you'll see it begins to be personalized, but that's when you start getting into the fulfillment in Christ. So in my opinion, if I had to translate this as unbiased as possible, I just translated it. That's the normal way you would do this if you didn't have any other theological considerations.
So, and without it, nothing became...
Okay. Hen, one thing. It's a neuter form of the word for one. You know, heis, mia, hen. So, and it would be one thing, you might want to translate it. Yeah, nothing. Yeah, not one thing, nothing.
Okay, not one thing.
See, ude hen together would be not one thing.
Well, they had
udes,
which meant nothing.
Yeah, there was a combined form that was used too. This is kind of the split up form. This is a longer, maybe even more emphatic this way. You know, not one thing. Not a thing, not one, you know. That's kind of the idea. Yeah, it would be, in other words, the paradigm of udes would include this. Yeah, and udemia, and then uden, you know, you have them all. Okay, any other questions on there? Yes.
In fact, they didn't make condensed form, this means it's really being...
Yeah, I think you get a sense of more emphasis. This is the way you usually operate, is that if things can be condensed and shortened, they tend to run together and you don't get quite the same emphasis on them. When they are purposely placed in the longer forms, or the words are split up or something, then you get more emphasis. It calls your attention to it, you know, it's more precise.
I'm wondering what Paul Galen and why they Nestle sticks it on the end of this.
Oh, okay. It means that which has come to be, the thing which has come to be. See, it's a participle. Third person singular, second perfect active indicative, second person perfect active indicative. So the thing which has come to pass, you know, ho gegonen, using the relative pronoun and then the thing that has come to pass. So the thing that has come to pass is a way to translate that phrase. That which has come to pass or come to be, in a more neutral sense, that which has come to be. And King James says, you know, without him was not anything made that was made. They put the phrase that was made there to get that hogegon in. And then the other translations are saying, the thing which has come to pass in him, you know, was life. In other words, they make that the subject of the next sentence, rather than something that's tacked on as a kind of an appositive relative pronoun phrase attached to the previous sentence. So that's where the debate lies, and it could go either way. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, see, and the ones that translate it with the Hegonen, they just translate verse 4, in him was life. No, life was, and make life the subject of that. And if you do it the other way, then you have Hogegonen now the subject, and Zoe the predicate nominative. So kind of a choice between the two there. But it would be very difficult to nail this down concretely, you know, as to which it is. And they give notes down here for different punctuations and different texts and so forth on this. Okay. So, Eric, why don't you go ahead and read the Hogegon, and we'll just translate this as part of this, but realize there is some debate on this.
The life was the light of men.
Yes, and the life was the light of men. Okay. And that Gegonin form there, the whole there is not an article, but a relative pronoun. And Gegonin would be a perfect form there with that reduplicated syllable from Ginomai. Mark.
What would we want to translate then, that and that which...
Yes, that which has come to be.
That which is, or that which came to be and still is, or...
Oh, yes. That's kind of hard to get the sense of the perfect. You're really kind of talking about that which came to be at one time and still is. If you really wanted to get that full, you know, that which has come to be and still is, you might be the way to do it, because it's many times context will be sufficient to translate a perfect, and the English will give the same connotation in context. But in something like this, especially in anything in the prologue of John, you know, you need to be careful with it, because you don't really have a lot of clear context to go by. Yeah. The implication, though, is that it's that which has come to be, and it still is. It's still abiding in him, was life. And the life was the light of men. Notice we start with life without the article, and then the next phrase, and the life. So it kind of catches your attention, too. Now we're specifying this attribute called life, and the life was the light of men. This one, this predication too, ein hezoe, ein tophos, ton anthropon. That one's a real hard one as far as deciding which is the subject and which is the predicate nominative, because you've got articles on both of them. And the preference would probably be for zoe, simply because zoe was mentioned in the previous context, the previous phrase. So that would be the thing you'd have to go by.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't we also give, I noticed in John's Gospel that he tends to be a little bit more linear in his than, let's say, Matthew or Paul.
Oh, the Apostle Paul, yes.
And even from that standpoint, there'd be more of a chance to feel that he is
a
subject that he tends to do that.
Yeah, he does very definitely tend to do that. Take one thing at a time and take it in order and lead you from one point to another point. In fact, this prologue will do that. You know, we start off with logos, then we get to life, then we get to light, and so forth, and it's progressive. So, yeah, I think that's a good point. Okay, verse 5. Who's up next? Oh, John, question?
The interesting thing between the anarchist and articulate Zoe, there seems to be that there must be, there's a definiteness there to draw.
Yes.
To do something.
Yes.
To emphasize something.
Sure.
As though, in the first place, it's not like they're not identical. They're not identical, but they are. They're related, but they're not identical.
Yeah. It's the perception of it. See, what's happening in the first clause is that life is being introduced and defined. In other words, it's the thing which has come to be in him was life. So now we're calling this thing which has come to be, we're calling that life. As for the first time we use a label like that, we're using more of the anarthra sense to get the quality aspect of it, because that's what we're trying to see. And now that we've defined it, now we can say the life, that is the life we've just defined by the previous clause. Now we've specialized that concept by that previous clause, and now we can start using the life we've just been talking about, and then proceed with that. Mm-hmm. That's very typical.
And then how is the way used? Is it living things, or is it, we can say life.
Okay.
Exists, you know,
yeah, that's a harder question to answer just because of the context of John 1. If this weren't in John 1, it'd probably be easier to answer. It's the same situation you have with logos. You know, you can see that logos in John 1 is gaining some senses and a conceptual basis that goes beyond even its uses in other passages. We're kind of getting down to the substrata, the basis of what all these things mean. And so I would say life here is a conceptualization of the whole concept of life. I think it's focusing on spiritual life in Christ, but it's including all of life, period, in the sense that he's talking about the beginning here. He's talking about the basic principles upon which the whole universe is constructed. And to me, anyway, theologically, this life is talking about life in every sense of the word. The life of angels, the life of even the devil and the demons who fell, the human life, animal life, plant life, life period, but focusing upon spiritual life in Christ, which is the reason why all other life came into being. And so I think that's kind of what that which has come to be in him was life. In it, referring to the Logos, to be more accurate here. The thing that came to be in the Logos is life. He's trying to connect the concept of Logos with the concept of life, showing that life is the product of the plan of God and the purpose and intent that God had in the beginning.
Then I guess also we see that later it's being related to light and contrasted with darkness.
Right. And that's where you're starting to see this connection between, with the spiritual life, especially with light and darkness. And see, even here it says, "In the life was the light of men." So we're seeing connection that you know there's a sense in which all life is a light for man. The fact that life exists in any form is a testimony to a creator. But I think it goes beyond that. We're starting to see that it's to indicate to us a spiritual light and a spiritual life that we're to be looking toward. And that's the basic foundation upon which everything else is created. Okay, you see what I mean, how hard it is to keep from getting into a lot of the theological implications? And I'm not going to, you know, try to prevent us from doing all of that. We just have to be careful we don't spend the rest of the hour on the Logos, you know, and not get the rest of the chapter done. So, but I do want to point out some things, because there's some things we're going to see as we go through here you probably won't get any other way. And especially going verse by verse, I really wish we had time to go through the entire New Testament, verse by verse, you know, this way. That's someday maybe we'll have special classes or something, we can do that. I don't know if we'd ever get through with it. So, yeah, we'd have to really discipline ourselves. Okay, but on your own, I would recommend this as an exercise. You know, you could set up a reading schedule and say, you know, a half an hour a day or half an hour a week, or pick a time and start going through it verse by verse and just see what you can come up with. I think you're gonna pick up some things you never would have picked up otherwise. Okay, verse 5. Who's up next? Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
And the light in the darkness shines.
Yes, it's present form.
Earth?
Yeah.
Shines. The darkness.
Okay, yeah, does not know or comprehend is what they give for that. Yes, the Katelaben is aorist. That's the second aorist. Yeah. The Lambano was a crazy one. It's, yeah. This is a compound from Lambano. Yeah, Katelambano. Mm-hmm. And notice it becomes Katelaben because of the augment. The augment on these compound verbs comes in between there. And so I think we had Lambano and then Elaben for the aorist, so it's Katelaben. And this is an interesting word, too. Remember what Lambano means by itself?
Receive.
And then would you put Kata on it, what would that mean?
Receive down.
To receive down. And the idea of comprehend and so forth is the way they translate it. Understand, comprehend, various ideas there. But the idea there is being able to receive it down. In other words, to take it in and make it yours and, you know, lay it down in your mind, as it were, to receive it down in your mind.
Yeah.
So it makes some sense.
So it's have not.
Yeah, did not receive or had not received. It's a little bit hard with an aorist to get the exact sense, but...
I don't get it then. Why you switch from the light in the darkness is shining, and the darkness had not received it, had not accepted it.
Right. You're switching tenses here, but I think the idea is that... the first clause is kind of putting you in the past tense almost. It's giving a present verb form. But this will happen sometimes when, I think they call it a historical present or something sometimes in writing, where they kind of take you back and you see the picture. And the light is shining in the darkness, but the darkness comprehended it not. So it's kind of a more personalizing and bringing you into it to see the light shining in the darkness. And maybe also to convey the fact that it's still going on. It's something that happened back there, but it's still going on. The light's still shining in the darkness. The light shines in the darkness, kind of as a general maxim. and the darkness comprehended it not. They put the aorist there because we're getting a little bit more focusing now on the specific historical things. We're starting, this is kind of making a transition between more of the conceptual frame and now getting into a more of a historical frame, because the next verse is going to start talking about John and, you know, getting, see, verse 5 is forming the transition between that conceptual framework of John 1:1 and then the historical sequence, starting with the John the Baptist, who's the forerunner, and then Christ. So I think that may be a part of the reason for it. Those are the very interesting things, you know, to notice. There's a present form, and then we go to an aorist form. And why, you know, and try to dig into the context and other things for reasons why that's happening. And you can begin to see a sense of change that's taking place here. Okay, verse 6, Mark.
One passage. It also possibly the aorist in the sense of...
That indefinite idea, you mean?
Well, no.
I got your sense there. Just because of the very nature, darkness never has, is not, and never will be able to comprehend it. And so to kind of some of the darkness comprehended it not, that's it's kind of a, there's an air of finality to it, even though even in the future there'll be darkness that doesn't, won't comprehend it in the future. There's a certain degree of finality to the idea because darkness is not going to ever be able to comprehend it. So that may be a sense, too, that you could look at as a secondary thing.
Seems, Ben, you're reading in a... almost a perfect idea to if darkness could not, but you're not, you stop saying that.
Yeah.
You're saying it didn't, like historically,
yeah.
It just didn't.
Yeah.
It had a chance to, and, you know, lost it. And,
well, I think what Mark is saying is the fact that a present was used first and then an aorist, it's not so much the fact that just an aorist is used here, but an aorist used in this context with having stated the first thing, that the darkness is, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not, to change over there, it kind of gives you the sense of a perfect kind of an idea because of the present fact still going on and then darkness not being able to comprehend it. In other words, it'd be a combination of things. Not just the verb alone. Aorist, has this indefinite aspect to it, and that opens the door for several kinds of translations. Very often, you'll find an aorist translated by a perfect in English, just because the aorist plus the context gives you the idea of progressive action. I mean, a continuing state of the thing. So, in other words, an aorist form does not preclude a perfect understanding in the context. It just is not maybe being more specific about that in the word itself. If you see a perfect form, you know from the word itself, and independent of the context, that you've got that aspect. But from the aorist, you may have an indefinite aspect with a verb plus context, and that may set some other things in view. So these are the kinds of things that you need to go into more detail with exegesis on. But knowing the data is where you begin. You know, the fact that we had a present and now we got an aorist, that's the thing that we need to say, well, what are the possibilities here? And we may not always agree 100% of the possibilities of the conclusions of that, but we need to know what the data is in order for even to go that far. Yes, John?
Are you saying, and can we include in this type of setup, that because you've got a present and an aorist in the same passage and they're relating to each other, those two ideas together do make a perfect, do make the concept of perfect in one. One takes place in the past, and one continuing in the present.
Yeah, I would say the whole concept is at least analogous to a perfect idea. That I wouldn't want to say it quite, draw the equation, because there are some other possibilities too. There's the possibility of this time projection element, you know, where you're first zeroing in on a general maxim, and then you're looking at the historical situation and making a transition there. So I'm not sure in my own mind which way I'd go on that. I'd probably want to do some more thinking and study and consult some other parallel passages that did the same thing before I made a real solid conclusion on it. So that's the kind of thing that's open for future study. But I would say that idea is one of the possibilities, because you're dealing with something that is going on, you know, using the present, getting that progressive aspect, and then using the aorist to tie into a certain aspect of that. It's very analogous to a perfect idea in that respect. Okay, verse 6, let's See, Mark, was that? We were at you. Okay. Okay.
A man came to be, having been sent from beside God, was the result of being sent. John.
Okay, good. That last phrase is interesting because onoma auto Ioannes, you've got two nominatives, onoma and Ioannes, and then that dative auto to him as showing this possession thing. And this is kind of a nominative, kind of an absolute nominative thing, you know, name to him John. I think we saw that as one of the cases of the uses of the nominative is to name something, and that's what's happening here. So it's both nominatives, there's no verb form, you know, the auto is just a dative tying to onoma. So it's kind of an interesting construction. Also, you caught that apestalmenos, that is a perfect participle. So you have that idea of a perfect, you know, a man having been sent from God and he's still abiding in that state in effect at the time that this is written.
Now, would we conclude that he was sent before he came to be this man, or?
Yes, in a certain sense, I think you would. It's not as clear with a perfect participle as it is with some of the aorists and so forth, but I would say this. There came to be a man sent from God. In one sense, the man came to be before he was sent, of course. I mean, if you're talking about birth and so forth, but I think this is looking at it from on the world scene. There came to be a man on the world scene who'd been sent from God. In other words, that's when anybody found out about him and so forth. That's when he's appearing in terms of his ministry and his function and so forth. And so this, again, auto doesn't necessarily imply origination in terms of birth or anything else. It came to be on the scene, you see, a man who was sent from God, having been sent from God, and whose name was John. Named to him John.
In other words, he was sent forth and had this calling of God before he came to be
Sure. I think so. You've got, you know, the cause and the effect relationship here. It's God's call first and then the appearance in the world and made known in the world. That's the kind of language is used frequently. There's a passage in Acts that talks about God having raised up his son and made in the nation, as it were, and made manifest these things. It's not talking about his resurrection. It's talking about him being raised up from among the people and then being shown forth. And John the Baptist the same way. He was raised up from among the people, as it were. And it's interesting that the New World Translation translates that there arose a man that was sent forth as a representative of God. His name was John. They translated arose. It's a pretty loose translation, but at least they're expressing the idea there that this arising is coming after his having been sent. Mm-hmm.
What I was wondering, maybe we could also tie this back to verse 3, that all things through him came to be, and this is one of those.
Come to be. Yeah, you see, we've been using agenito over and over again here. Now we've got agenito anthropos. This is one of the things that came to be. This is the ultimate cause of the logos in the beginning, and this is one of the things that comes to be as a result of the logos. And it comes to be in the world in terms of the world scene and the action and so forth. And John the Baptist had a similar kind of situation to Christ. He was a nobody for a time, and then all of a sudden he comes on the scene 6 months before Christ and has this ministry. So he wasn't as a little boy with his rough hairy garment, you know, out in the wilderness. It was at a certain point in time that he's commissioned to do that, and that's when he came to be, as far as the world scene is concerned. Yes.
I'm not sure I understand how this is a perfect.
Okay, it's from Apo and it's from apostello. That's the verb form, and we've got a passive form with the men there. I guess you just have to look at the root there to see. See, the trouble with this one is it's a compound, and it also it's got the sigma tau combination, which makes it, you know, is one of those that doesn't get reduplication. So that's why it's a little bit more. Let's see if you can check the back of Getches. Did they put that one back there? It might be good to look at all the forms. The reduplication, yeah, we'll still get reduplication. That's one of the things that identifies those participles as well. But,
and Stello.
Yeah. Okay, Stello, that's what we need. Okay. Yeah. Okay. The perfect middle and passive is estalmai. And so estalmenos, you see, is your form there. Your aorist would be estela, and future active stelo, and so forth. Estalka with a kappa there for the perfect active. So this is perfect middle and passive participle. And he didn't really say a lot about formation of participles, unfortunately. He didn't give you a full paradigm. I think he just made some comments down there, and you had to... you know, you had to build it on that base, and that's where your reduplication would have come in. Let me see if I can find a statement on it.
So the root was, I didn't think about the retention of capstone to alma.
Oh, okay.
And the alma is cut off because that's because of the decline.
Yeah. Well, just at the bottom of page 290, top of page 291, it says, menos, mene, menon, added to the perfect middle and passive base to form the perfect middle and passive participle. For example, lelumenos. See, for luo, you would have the reduplication, lelu. But the trouble with this verb is that it's got a sigma tau to start the stem, stelo, and that raises great complications with reduplication. Plus the fact that it's a compound with ape on the front, apo on the front, and that makes it more... You know, that's the kind of one you'd probably have to look up. You know, to see that apestalmenos, you might wonder what, you know, is this present? Is this aorist? Is this perfect? It might be any of those. You know, the menos can pretty much tell you that it's a passive idea or middle or passive idea, but even then it may be deponent too. So you still may have active meaning. So that's why there's lots of options on some of those, and I wouldn't expect you necessarily pick that up without having known the verb. Okay, verse 7. Okay.
This one came into a witness.
Mm-hmm.
In order to witness about the light, in order that all might believe through him.
Yes. Yeah, they're both subjunctive. That hina marchirese would be in order that he might witness. It's just your third person singular form. So you might say in order that he might witness peri tu photos concerning the light. And then another hina clause, hina pantes pistusos in arist, I mean arist subjunctive form, in order that all might believe through him. Good. So this one came, elfen is just an arist form for erkomai. Of course, the second aorist. And so this one came into a witness. This is a literal translation. This is ace being used for purpose. It came into a witness. That is, came for the purpose of being a witness. And in order that, and then it goes on to explain that, in order that he might witness concerning the truth, in order that all might believe through him. Mm-hmm.
I saw just an note on the day and about ace, how it's used.
Appearance
used like to dedicate oneself to a god,
mm-hmm.
Into a god.
Uh-huh.
A picture of dedication or surrender to surrender oneself to something.
Sure. There's a lot of conceptual ideas.